Back in the 1980s, when the AIDS epidemic hit, I saw far too many young men end their lives tragically, jumping off a bridge, driving the car into the river, having their partner suffocate them. And I said, there just has to be a better way.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. On this week's episode, Death with Dignity, a controversial law that makes it legal for terminally ill patients, meeting certain criteria, to take their own lives. How belief in God could have very real and adverse effects on human suffering. And delineating dying with dignity from suicide. All coming up on this week's Humanist Hour. Hello and welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Beau Bennett and I am your host for this week's episode. The argument goes that if God gives us life, then God is the only person who could take it away. Well, there are a few exceptions, of course, and if we're killing somebody in the name of God, then we have the right to take it away. Or if they're an unbeliever, or if they worship another god, or if they happen to be a child who is a wise ass to their parents, we could kill them. Or if they work on the Sabbath, you get the point. But basically, if God gives us life, then only God could take it away. But what if we don't believe in a god? What if there is no God that gives life? And life is actually just the result of cause and effect. And if you don't know what cause and effect I'm talking about, well, that's a whole other topic for another episode. It's something you probably should have learned about in seventh grade. But this raises an interesting question. Under what circumstances do we have the legal and moral, ethical right to take our own lives? And that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking specifically about a law called Death with Dignity. And we'll get into that with an expert in the area who's been following this and working in this area since 1994. His name is George Amey. George was an Oregon state legislator in 1997 when opponents to the Death with Dignity Act were working to dismantle the Citizens Initiative passed in 1994 and was instrumental in blocking the opponents in the legislature. After the law was implemented, George took up a leadership role in the executive director of Compassion and Dying in Oregon, which later became Compassion and Choices of Oregon. After 12 years helping terminally ill patients navigate Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, George retired in 2010. And I have the pleasure of speaking with Mr. George Amey. How are you, George?
Just fine, thank you.
Great, great. Well, I'll tell you why I contacted your organization. I recently read a story about a 29-year-old girl named Brittany Maynard. Are you familiar with the story?
I am very familiar with
okay.
it.
I bet you are then. I'll just tell you what I know about it. Basically, she has stage 4 glioblastoma. Is that pronounced correctly?
It's a brain tumor, yes.
Yeah, and she's 29 years old, and she was recently married, and she's choosing to end her life early. And here's a quote that really struck me. It says, "There is not a cell in my body that is suicidal or that wants to die. I want to live. I wish there was a cure for my disease, but there is not." So
yes.
This really struck a chord with me. What else can you tell us about this story?
Well, I think it's rare, first of all, that such a young person gets such a disease. And it's even further rare that someone of her age with such a disease would consider hastening her death, accelerating the point where she was going to die because she is so young. Mm. It is sad. It's unfortunate. But she has chosen something that is an option that's available to very few people in the United States. And she's chosen to move to Oregon to take advantage of our Death with Dignity law.
Okay.
Now, whether or not she decides to take the medicine when she says she is going to take it on November 1st, we never know. At least a quarter of the people who get the medicine never take it, die peacefully knowing that it's available, but have chosen not to take the medicine.
Oh, that's interesting. Interesting. Okay. So basically, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about the right for one to end one's own life. And maybe that's just too broad. Can you tell us about, well, there's a few things I'd like to know about, but why don't we start with the law itself?
There are three states that have the law on their statutes.
Okay.
Those three states are, the first state was Oregon, mm-hmm. which passed it in 1994, and then subsequently repassed it in 1997, and the first person to use it was in 1998. The second state was the state of Washington that passed the law in 2008, and the first person to use the law was in 2008. The next state to pass the law was Vermont in 2013, and to our knowledge, no one has used the law yet in Vermont. There are two other states that have judicial orders. One is the state of Vermont, which is a statewide order that gives immunity to doctors who choose to prescribe medicine to end one's life if they're terminally ill. And then there's a county in New Mexico that has a judge that ordered the same immunity for doctors if they prescribe for terminally ill patients. The problem with those latter two states, well, the one state and the one county, is that they don't have the same Oregon-type safeguards and guidelines that we believe are necessary. Therefore, to the best of our knowledge, nobody has ever used the law in Montana or New Mexico as of yet. New Mexico did it just this year, and Montana did it in 2008. So we believe the law, first of all, the purpose behind it was to provide an option for people facing a terminal diagnosis to end their pain and suffering in a humane and dignified manner. It was difficult to draft the law because we had to take into consideration all of the concerns that were expressed by proponents and opponents. Mm. Would the vulnerable be subject to abuse? Would the family members pressure loved ones into using it? Would there be euthanasia? The difference between, by the way, just a quick side note, euthanasia is self-administered, is administered by somebody else, whereas death with dignity, our statute, you must self-administer the medication that ends your life.
Mm, I gotcha. You mentioned before, however, that there are some states that do not have the full spectrum of these laws in place.
Yes.
Which basically means that if I were a doctor, I would be extremely hesitant to prescribe my patient a medicine that I know will kill my patient, even if it's kind of okay within the eyes of the law. Everything has to be in place for me to do that.
Correct. Even with immunity, even with the court's decision to give immunity to these physicians, they are a very cautious group as a whole, as it should be.
Yeah, sure.
And they are reluctant to prescribe a lethal dose of medication because they don't know how families are going to react. And even though they may be immune, they may be subject to a lawsuit which they have to defend and go through that whole process. Whereas when you have states like Oregon, Washington, and Vermont, where our organization, Death with Dignity National Center, was very instrumental in putting these safeguards and guidelines to make sure that doctors were more comfortable. And even then, there were very few doctors initially who were willing to participate because, again, as I said, a cautious group, and they moved very slowly. And now, of course, we have quite a number of doctors. When we first started, I had about 25 doctors in the whole state of Oregon that were willing to participate. Now we have over 1,200 doctors who have either participated as a prescribing physician or a consulting physician.
Gotcha. So is this a very active issue right now politically, or is this something that's been going on since 1994 and really doesn't get a lot of attention?
Well, let me just say that in 1994, it was one of the hotly contested issues in the state of Oregon. In 1994, we had a gubernatorial race a very significant gubernatorial race that was very hotly contested as well. And yet more people voted on the death with dignity issue than they did in the gubernatorial race, which was a very interesting phenomena, because there was strong feelings on both sides of the issue. It passed by a mere 51% to 49%.
Oh my goodness.
Then it was in court, the federal court system, for 3 years. And then we had to vote on it again because the Oregon legislature, in their wisdom, decided to send it back to the voters to vote on one more time. They said, you got it wrong the first time, so vote on it again. Well, the second time around, it passed by 60 to 40%. Then Congress attempted to overturn our law by penalizing doctors who participated. And that was 3 years of congressional onslaught that was defended by our U.S. Senator, Ron Wyden, who threatened to filibuster any time that they did it. And so that failed for three legislative sessions. Then in 2001, U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft, in his wisdom, decided to write a edict that said basically he would criminalize any physician in Oregon who participated in the law. Or and take away their license to prescribe controlled substances. Well, we immediately sued him. I was able to gather 12 patients who were going through the death with dignity process at the time, and they sued. And we, and the U.S. Supreme Court in 2006 said no, he could not do what he did, and that Oregon's law was legal. Other states then started to look at our law, because now they knew that it was legal. And Washington was the next state that chose to have a citizens initiative pass it by voter referendum. And that passed by practically 59% of the voters approved the law in the state of Washington. Then our next state, 5 years later, was Vermont, which did it legislatively. Now we're looking at other New England states, southwestern states, and the possibility of California. So it is becoming an issue again. It's becoming a very controversial issue. The Brittany Maynard case is brought it to the forefront, mainly because she is so young and because she was so vibrant and articulate. It has gone viral. There's no question, more than 5 million hits already on her video. It is something that is educating the public. I think in the short term, it's having a good positive impact in the sense that people are talking about their end-of-life decisions.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Mr. George Amey on the death with dignity issue.
I have always advocated that young people should be aware that something like this could happen, a car accident, a brain tumor, or something. So they should be preparing advanced directives and their wills and telling their loved ones what their wishes are, if in fact they are terminal. In the long run, this, like many other situations, I don't know if you remember the Schiavo case in Florida, where a young woman was in a coma for about 17 years, and there was a very legal, logistic, litigious fight over her being withheld food and water. Well, that case was very controversial for many, many years, and now it is settled back. So it's the cumulative effect of many cases like that which are changing the minds and hearts of the American public, so that I think we're going to get to a critical mass soon where other states are going to start looking at Oregon's death with dignity law and start passing it.
Okay. So what exactly is this Compassion and Choices organization? And how does that relate to the death with dignity law?
Compassion and Choices started a little shortly after our organization. Our organization started off as the Right to Die PAC, and it was a political action committee that started off to pass the law in the state of Oregon. And then along came this compassion organization, which at the time was called Compassion in Dying. And they started in the state of Washington to try to try to change the law there, but it failed in the state of Washington and California. Well, we then matured into a national organization called Death with Dignity National Center as an outgrowth of the Right to Die PAC. And we're the organization basically that attempts to protect the law in court system and to pass the law in other states.
Okay.
Compassionate Choice's initial mission was to implement the law. In other words, once the law was passed, they would set up organizations that would facilitate people going through the law. And that was my position with Compassion and Choices of Oregon for 12 years as the executive director. I facilitated people going through the process. I would connect them with their doctors to make sure that everything was going okay. I would explain to doctors what the medicine was. I would refer them to pharmacies. We would assign volunteers to them to guide them through, answer all of their questions about how do you die, when do I take the medicine, what happens to me afterwards, all of these myriad of questions that come up for families and patients before they take the medicine. And that organization then, when I left back, I retired in 2010 and became the a board member and now vice chair of Death with Dignity National Center, because I started flying all over the country to speak on the issue and went to Vermont a half a dozen times to get the law passed there. Well, they then decided that they wished to expand their reach and started trying to pass the law in other states. And they went into California and New Jersey, and they've been really unsuccessful in that. That mostly what Compassion and Choice is best is at implementing the law. They're not as adequate at trying to pass the law as we are, because we've got the political expertise.
I see.
Having said that, they then were approached by a person who had a contract with Brittany to tell her story on the web. And they bought the rights to tell her story from this group. And that's how they've been promoting Brittany's story. But of course, Brittany's story now is in the public domain, and therefore anyone can talk about it and discuss it. But it was mainly Compassionate Choice's purpose was to raise funds.
Gotcha.
And it was disappointing for me to see that, because I've been always an advocate for the patient solely doing it on their own, independent of publicity and that type of thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, George, why exactly are you so passionate about this topic?
Well, I can tell you several reasons, but primarily back in the 1980s, when the AIDS epidemic hit very hard in the United States, I was the chair of the board of an organization that was equivalent to a hospice for people dying of AIDS. And I saw far too many young men end their lives tragically, jumping off a bridge, driving the car into the river, having the partner suffocate them. And I said, there just has to be a better way.
So you mentioned AIDS, which is kind of interesting. And here is probably one of the big issues that people might have against this Death with Dignity law. Now, you were... I guess you said that during the AIDS epidemic, when it was at its peak, maybe back in the 80s or 90s, and people were committing suicide, jumping off of bridges, doing things like horrible things in order to end their lives. But eventually, and correct me if I'm wrong here with my ignorance, I'm not up to date on a lot of the medical treatments, but isn't AIDS now, I don't know if it's curable, but it's, you could extend your life indefinitely if you have it. It's no longer definitely fatal due to the medications we have.
Yeah. It's become a chronic illness.
Okay.
And even though the Death with Dignity movement was partially started because of the AIDS epidemic, very, very few people with AIDS ever used the law. It's now people with cancer, and which is very interesting because that was the purpose behind letting those people die with dignity was our purpose. Well, now we're, of course, expanded to people with end-of-life diseases like cancer, ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, that type of thing. And they are using the law predominantly.
Gotcha.
So AIDS, I think one every 5-6 years, you'll get somebody with AIDS that is going to use the law. And today, the people with AIDS that use the law, not because they don't have medication to control their illness. It's called AIDS exhaustion. They just get exhausted after 15, 20 years on a regimen that is controlling their lives, taking their medicines on, and then they get all the opportunistic illnesses that come with it. And so finally they just say, no more. I'm going to stop taking all my medicines.
Okay.
And that's how they die, but it's rare, very rare.
Okay.
So, it's not the AIDS epidemic anymore.
All right. So there's basically two issues there. And the first one, which I was getting at, is if people lose all hope and just assume that a disease is certainly terminal and there's no chance for any kind of cure, then, I mean, we've seen with AIDS, that's not the case. So if there were people who were, and you said clearly it wasn't happening a lot, if at all, but if there were people who were ending their own lives because they lost all hope and they thought that they were definitely going to die because of AIDS, and then maybe a couple days later, a cure was announced, isn't that an argument against death with dignity? And let's say that could happen with ALS or that could happen with cancer or anything else. Don't you see that as a decent argument?
No, it is not.
Okay.
Let me just explain why.
Sure.
First of all, the so-called quote-unquote miracle drugs or miracle cures that come along, they're very rare to begin with. And generally speaking, there is a period in which there has to be human testing. And the announcement of the human testing is generally 5 to 10 years before they can start doing it. And these people who have these rare diseases, whatever they may be, cancers or even AIDS, they're tested. And so when the protease inhibitors came along in the early 90s, there was a lot of people that started getting tested, mm-hmm. and they did help. But that didn't mean that it came overnight. It wasn't 2 days later, after a person had taken a lethal dose of medication and died, that these medications came along. They were on them late stage. Terminality cannot be addressed by these miracle drugs, and rarely is. It's people in the early stages that generally are helped with these types of cures.
Okay.
And so, you know, you have somebody like Brittany who has late stage brain cancer. There's nothing. It has now metastasized to her spine, to her lymph nodes. There's just no way that there would be a miracle cure to come along to do so. Hmm. And you know, what we always have said, that the purpose of the law is not to necessarily use it, but to have it as an option if worse comes to worse. And the people who use the law, very few do, they are people who recognize that they would love to live. They're mentally mentally competent. They would love to live, but they know they're going to die and their death is imminent. Two doctors have determined that, and they are ready to end their suffering on this earth. And they therefore have chosen this option. They find great comfort in knowing it's an option to them. And those few who do take it, and I've been honored and privileged to be with about four dozen who've done so, are some of the bravest individuals in the world.
Mm. And I think you hit on one of the key words there, and that is choice or option. I know as a humanist, it really does seem like one of the issues, one of the big issues, that we should have the choice. We should have the right to do something that affects our own lives in that way. And I think that's where many humanists would stand on the issue. I would definitely say that many humanists would not exercise that right to take their own lives. And I'm probably one of them. You never know until you're in that position. But it does make sense that the choice is what is really important. And the choice is what we should, as humanists, give to individuals.
That's right. And in fact, I can assure you that having worked with over 1,700 people who died during my 12 years at the organization, that was probably the number one issue. You have given me hope in giving me the option. And the choice is mine. And I cannot tell you the number of times family members contacted me after we discussed it with their loved one about the process and that how whether they were eligible or not. These loved ones would say, I don't know what you did or what you said, but for the first time in months, my loved one is smiling again and it feels good again. And I said, it's nothing we have done. We've just informed them of their option. And they know that if worse comes to worse, this is their option. And that gives people a great deal of comfort. Now, for those who believe in the miracle cures, and I can tell you, one of the concerns of our organization and of the opponents of the law was that people would be pressured into using this for financial reasons or for just simply saying, you know, mom, dad, husband, wife, I just can't take this anymore. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the exact opposite. The dying person must persuade the family that this is something they wish to consider. The family always is saying, please, let's try something. I read about a cure in Mexico, or I read about pigeon guana or whatever in bat guana in Alabama. And they want them to try every single option to keep them alive. And of course, because we love these people, we want to keep them alive as long as possible.
Right.
And so you don't want to, you say, don't give up. Well, when the dying person says, I love you very much, I've tried it all, I've done the chemo, I've done the radiation, I've done everything, I choose not to live like this any longer. It's not a life that's any longer acceptable to me. I tell family members, shouldn't you respect your loved one's choice?
Yeah. Right.
And most people do.
Now, it might seem kind of ironic talking about well-being when somebody is this ill and about to die, but one of the key factors of well-being psychologically is choice. And if you take away somebody's choice, or if you don't give somebody a choice, they are much worse off than if they do have a choice. So I could see where just having this choice available, and as you say, which I find incredibly interesting, that at least 25% of the people who have this choice and say that they're going to use it, they don't. They end up not using it. And it just really firms up this whole idea that it's really about this choice and having this choice available.
And I can also tell you that people, sadly, we've learned sometimes too late, have been told by people who oppose the law, no, I will not help you, end up ending their lives tragically. And it's because you have removed that hope from them. And that is sad, very, very sad. And I tell people who oppose the law over and over again, I respect your position. I respect that you have a differing philosophical, religious position than I have. But please, when a person approaches you, and these are mostly the medical professionals, when a person like this, your patient, approaches you to ask you for help, you may say, I disagree with this, but please refer them to either an organization that will guide them elsewhere, or have them talk to another doctor. Because to tell them right off the bat, no, you're mentally incompetent as far as I'm concerned if you ask this, you've got suicidal tendencies if you ask this, is wrong. It's just an almost tantamount to medical malpractice, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. It's unfortunate, and I'm sad to say that some of the religious hospitals who have orders that they will not allow their physicians to participate or even talk about death with dignity do this on a regular basis.
Well, let's talk about this for a moment. And I was wondering how, well, both from a legal aspect and from a philosophical aspect, how does death with dignity differ from suicide?
Well, we first started finding out about the definition difference. Suicide is, by dictionary definition, is taking one's life. There's no question about it. However, the people who choose to end their lives under the death with dignity law are insulted when it's referred to as suicide. Therefore, we have come to the conclusion that language and definition of that language matters. Suicide traditionally is understood by the public as having been done by a person who is severely depressed, who is generally physically okay, and who simply wishes to end their life. A person who uses death with dignity is not severely depressed. They're mentally competent, and they would love to live if they could.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Mr. George Amy on the death with dignity issue.
So there is a difference between the two. And so we've chosen to say it's physician aid in dying, it's death with dignity, it's physician aid in death, other terms that may be neutral, but not suicide. Now, I want you to know that in the beginning, back in the it was the late 80s and early 90s, we never used the term suicide, but the opposition did. And the media picked it up because, as the media will do, they like controversy.
Yeah, sure.
And, all right, and now the media does give a balanced approach, even though, in my opinion, to continue to say opponents use physician-assisted suicide is inappropriate as well. But this gets me on my bandwagon about media's need to always give an opposite point of view, regardless of whether that opposite point of view has any credibility or not.
Sure.
But that's a different story.
Sure. Yeah. Well, there's a couple issues here that that makes it kind of difficult to delineate all of these different terms and what this issue is all about. Because I heard you at some point talk about imminent death. That was kind of one of the key terms that we use. But also in the one case you mentioned somebody with AIDS who was just eternally suffering, you talked about suffering. And in a way, it's okay for suffering as well, even if the person is not going to definitely die very soon. So what is it? Is it suffering? Is it imminent death? Or is it a combination of both? Or does it not even matter?
It has to be both. First of all, two physicians, in their medical opinion, who are expert in your disease, must say that, in their medical opinion, you have 6 months or fewer to live because of your illness, underlying illness, and that you must be mentally competent to make the request, and then you go through the process.
So imminent death is a requirement.
It is a requirement in the law. In the three states that have the law, you must have two physicians that sign documents to that effect that are sent into the Department of Human Services to confirm that.
Okay, I think I understand a little bit better now. So let's change directions and talk about religion for a moment. What is your response when somebody says this is redemptive suffering actually cleans the soul and assures one entry into heaven as an argument? Yeah. What's your response to that?
I was raised a Catholic, and I worked in a nursing home when I was a teenager, and redemptive suffering was the response always for people screaming in pain. Mm-hmm. At a young age, I could not understand that argument at all. I understood redemptive suffering in the sense that if you wanted to achieve a goal, lose weight, become an athlete, get muscle bound, whatever the case may be, at the end of which you achieve something, and it was suffering that redeemed you in the sense that made you a better person. But redemptive suffering in the sense that at the end of which you're going to suffer even more, and you're going to be more in pain, and you're going to die, what have you achieved? And of course, the response was always from the priest and the nuns, a key to the entry of heaven.
Yeah,
I could not accept that. I have never accepted that. And I think many, many Catholics of today do not accept that either. But my response to them is to the rank and file of the Catholics and of the other religions that believe in that, is that is okay for you to believe that, but please, I respect your religion. Could you respect my position as well? Hmm. I am not going to force you, and I would hope that you not force me.
Sure.
Unfortunately, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church makes these edicts and imposes it upon the rank and file. And in fact, has got to the point where they can be punitive to the rank and file, especially if they're employees of the Catholic Church, such as all of the Catholic-owned hospitals and hospices throughout the United States that have Edict Number 51 that was issued that simply says nobody shall be participating in death with dignity. And they will be punished, either fired or evicted or not have privileges at the hospital if they participate. Well, that then becomes a problem. And I say to the Catholic hierarchy, not to the rank and file, because there are some very, very good people in the rank and file, and they do some good things, very good things. But to the hierarchy, it is hypocrisy that you continue to act in this way. It is hypocrisy that in one hand, you do not allow your priest to marry, but if they come in as a married man, then you allow them to be a priest. It's hypocrisy when you tell that you want to alleviate the pain and suffering of the starving in the world, and yet you tell a mother that you must die before, if you're pregnant, because we're not going to abort the baby. These are things that bother me tremendously. I do not say it to the rank and file, but I do say it to the hierarchy.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, you hit on the main point there. When people talk about suffering and redemptive suffering, something has to be redeemed, and usually that's at the end of the rainbow. Like when you mentioned about exercising and you look great, you feel great, and that's the result of all the work you do. But when there is nothing at the end of the rainbow, the only other way is to imagine there's something. And that's where people throw out these afterlife stories. Whether it's entry to heaven or 72 virgins, it doesn't matter. You know, there's something on the other side. So would it be a fair assumption to say that most of the criticism against dying with dignity comes from those who base their disagreement on their religious beliefs?
Absolutely. Probably, I would estimate 80% comes from religious belief. The other 20% comes in a couple categories. There's some people who, the disabled people, who believe that the law somehow denigrates their existence as disabled people, even though we have, in so many ways, we even put in a law, an amendment to the law saying that no person with a disability can use the law. They must be terminal. But that's just nothing we can do. They always talk about Hawking's. He would use the law, and they said, no, he wouldn't. First of all, he wouldn't qualify. He has a type of ALS that wouldn't qualify him for the use of law. And besides that, he has chosen to live. He's chosen to live a long and productive life, one of the world's geniuses. The other group are the physicians who have a ethical disagreement with the law, because the Hippocratic Oath has a provision in it that says, do no harm, basically, at least the modern-day Hippocratic Oath. And that, in their opinion, if they should prescribe, they're doing harm. Whereas all the physicians who participate in the law say, no, it's the exact opposite. If I do not help this person, I am doing harm.
Yeah.
So it's an ethical thing. And I respect that. I just say, okay, that's why we put an opt-out provision in the law. We gave you the right to opt out.
Right.
But that does not give you the right to condemn somebody who is participating.
Yeah. Yeah, it does seem to come down to values. And I think that harm is, you know, I think that's a perfect example. One physician may say, yeah, if I kill somebody, that's committing harm. And the other one might say, if I allow this person to suffer miserably, I am committing harm. It's just that's like right. if you hit a deer and the deer's suffering and going crazy, you break its neck. I've never done that before, but I've seen it on movies.
Well, I can tell you that all of the supporters over the years generally refer to their pets, that we do better in ending the suffering of our pets than we do our human beings.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Wow. So what are some of the other arguments against dying with dignity that are non-religious? Because, of course, we can go through scores of religious arguments that have no basis in reality as we know it. But what are some of the arguments against dying with dignity from the secular group?
Okay. One of the arguments is that it undermines the patient-physician relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow most physicians... philosophy is that they must keep their patients alive. Death is not an option. Hmm. It is keeping them alive for as long as they can. Well, we have found now over 16 years that, in fact, it has improved the relationship between physician and patient because there is more honesty and there is more discussion about all of the things. Once the physician hears from their patient, I wish to die and I wish to use the organs, death with dignity or the death with dignity. The physician says, well, wait a minute, why? Why are you wanting to do this? Well, because I cannot endure this suffering anymore. Well, then let's look at that. Let's look at, can we get you into palliative care? Can we get you into hospice care? Can we give you something that will improve your quality of life?
Yeah,
and that has actually been a benefit of the law. Another one is that it will create a situation that breaks down the family structure, in that family members will argue, don't do it, do it, that type of argument. Again, 16 years of evidence shows that, in fact, it has improved the relationship. A study that was recently done by Dr. Linda Ganzini at Oregon Health Sciences University shows that in a group of people whose loved one died using the law versus a group of survivors who did not use the law. In the first group, the memory of the dying process was more memorable and gratifying. And the people who in that first group, their grief was shorter, because they had that time to say goodbye to their loved ones. And it's very interesting that that was a positive outcome of the law, something we did not anticipate.
Yeah.
And another argument is money. Go, you know, hurry up and die because you're wasting money. Again, the reasons people use the law is loss of actual loss of autonomy, or the fear of loss of autonomy, or the diminution of the quality of one's life. Money is way, way down the list as almost insignificant. The reason that's true, our data shows, is that, first of all, most of these people, 95% of them, have insurance of some form or another. So money is not the reason. Their medical costs are being covered. Secondly, most of them are in, over 90% are in hospice care. So their quality of life is even better during their ending days. And that they are fiercely independent. The characteristic of these individuals, fiercely independent, generally highly educated, and middle to upper middle income. That doesn't mean there are some that are on the other extremes, but that means that that's the general population. Sure. So all of those concerns have been addressed by the data that we have gathered over the years. Another one was that only the weak and only the liberals will use this law. False. First of all, these are among the bravest individuals I've ever met in my life. They are strong, self-reliant, used to doing it their own way all their lives. They break down, and about 41% of the people that use the law are self-identify as Republican, about 43% self-identify as Democrat, wow. And the rest are independent or non-affiliated. Wow. About 50% self-identify as belonging to a religious organization. About 25% say they're spiritual, but do not belong to any religious organization. 25% are either agnostic or atheist.
Wow.
So again, it is a huge cross-section of our society. It is not sort of a narrow little group. And I think that refutes a lot of these arguments as well.
Yeah, it sure does. That is surprising. I would think that they would be mostly liberal, mostly non-religious, but from the numbers and from the stats that you just gave me, that pretty well represents a good cross-section of the population, of the American population. Well, George, this has been fantastic. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking to me about this. This is really a new topic for me, and I just did maybe an hour of research prior to our discussion to kind of educate myself and what's going on, but you really shed some light on this and it made me think about it a lot. It's not a, fortunately, it's not a topic that I had to think of, and I hope I never do, but you know, eventually we all get there.
You will, excuse me, but you must think about it. What I've always told people, if you plan, if you've got an advanced directive, if you've got your will, you can live life to its fullest then without that sort of facing you in the future. Talk to family and friends about what would happen if I were in an automobile accident and I was in a coma. Would you want to be removed from life support? Would you want to have every extraordinary measure taken to keep you alive? Whatever the case may be, let people know that. Yeah. Let the people you love know that so that they will not have to go through the anguish of making a decision about that.
So is that the same, though, George? Is that the same as what we've been talking about? Like if you're unconscious on life support and having somebody else pull the plug, isn't that a completely different issue than actually?
That's a completely different issue.
Yeah.
But the fact is, death with dignity is also part of that package.
Gotcha.
It is part of that discussion that you should have.
Gotcha.
If I get to a point in my life where death is imminent and I qualify, I am going to choose this law, or at least I want to consider using the law.
Right.
And they should know that. And I think it's very important that they know it. Because if you wait up until the end, then you're going to have all the struggles and the angst and all of the things that accompany that discussion. So have it now. And then it's out of the way. It's out of the way, and you can live life to its fullest.
Yeah. Wow. Well, certainly a lot to think about. George, once again, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. And where can people go to find out more about this cause and your organization?
Okay, just go to death.com. with Dignity. Just Google Death with Dignity National Center, and you will get our page.
All right. George, thank you again. I appreciate it.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And there you have it, a nice light issue for you. Well, this was a very interesting conversation for me, and generally it's something I don't like to think about a lot, one's own death, but maybe we should, maybe we all should put a little mental energy towards that and plan for the future, who knows. After thinking about this some more, again, you never know what you're going to do until you're actually put in that position. I don't know if I'd ever... It all depends on the suffering, you know, how much suffering that you actually have. But once again, I would like to have the choice. And I think that's very important. As usual, if you have any feedback, send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanisthour.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. My name is Bo Bennett. Thank you so much for listening in to the Humanist Hour podcast, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye, everybody.